Hiya, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about a really brilliant book, Sacred Modernity, Nature, Environment and the Post-Colonial Geographies of Sri Lankan Nationhood by Tariq Jazeel. Tariq is at the Department of Geography at UCL, and the book is published by Liverpool University Press and is also available locally in Sri Lanka. The book is a call for us to rethink the supposedly secular spaces of modernity in Sri Lanka, and it does so through two different sites. The first site is Rahuna National Park, and the second site is Tropical Modernism Architecture. It really is a fascinating and intellectually stimulating book, and I can't recommend it enough. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Tariq Jazeel to New Books in South Asian Studies. Hi Tariq, thanks a lot for coming on.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, very good. So I enjoyed the book very much, but before we get to talking about sacred modernity in depth, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your past projects, your past research, and how this fed into your latest book.
So I guess the book has been a long time in the making, actually, and it's fair to say that my interest in the relationships between landscape, nature, and the politics of ethnicity and difference in Sri Lanka goes right back, actually, to research I did when I was doing a master's degree in cultural geography at Royal Holloway University of London. And since then, I've conducted various research projects on different kinds of landscapes, different kinds of spaces of nature and environment in the Sri Lankan context, through which Sinhala Buddhist power and the politics of nationhood and identity are instantiated and also contested. And that's really what the book is about. But it's also fair to say that the book is part of a bigger sort of preoccupation I've had with the relationships between different kinds of spatialities and this very mutable and multivalent signifier, i.e. Sri Lankanness, which I have to say in turn comes from growing up as part of the Sri Lankan diaspora, as someone also of mixed Sri Lankan parentage. My mother is Tamil, my father is Muslim, and therefore I think, you know, I've always struggled in some senses to get to grips with the different and contested levels, locations, and the ways really through which identity is lived and negotiated in the Sri Lankan context. So, you know, the book is really part of that ongoing process to kind of work through some of those issues, I think.
That's great. And so this research, you started doing this research many years ago for this book, or
Yeah, the book, parts of it come actually from my doctoral research, and then there are a number of postdoctoral research projects, particularly on the architecture side of things, that have comprised large parts of the book as well. So it's in terms of actual research projects, there's some of my my PhD research in there, a lot of the stuff on the national park. Rahuna National Park was conducted around about the time when I did my PhD, and then a lot of the second part of the book on tropical modern architecture was conducted in years subsequently. But it's research that's been ongoing, I would say, over the last 10 years or so, which is why I say the book's been a long time in the making.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed in the book there was some interviews that were from, I don't know, 2006 or 7 or something like this, and then some more recent stuff as well. So you could really, it was nice that you could really get this this depth there of something. You could tell it was something that had been researched over a long period. So let's talk a bit about the book itself. And before we talk about these two sites, the National Park and Tropical Modernism Architecture, let's talk about the title. So Sacred Modernity. So it's what are you trying to get at with this title?
Yeah, good question. I wanted to use that phrase because of something of the tension that it suggests. Tension between, on the one hand, the pre-modern nature of religion, of the sacred, and on the other hand, the political modernity that we assume somehow must be secular. And really, I guess, in something of a nutshell, my argument in the book is that Buddhism and its aesthetic and ethnic domain has been a central component of the political project of post-independent Sri Lankan nation building. So hence sacred modernity, which I wanted to use, as I say, to denote a kind of commingling of religion and political modernity, or a way of talking about an alternative modernity wherein the religious has its own trajectory of becoming modern, part of everyday life, that is. Mm-hmm. And part of the project of the of building the very modern political institution of the state. But, I mean, you've read the book, so you'll know that the book's not about political institutions as such. It's about the politics of everyday life, space and landscape. Mm-hmm. But really, yeah, the sort of commingling of that... those assumptions about the pre-modernity of religion and the modernity of nation building.
And to do this in the introduction, is it, I don't know if it's the introduction or the first chapter of the book, you interrogate these two concepts of nature and religion and a sort of binary idea that we have of them, maybe in Western thought. I don't know, how does tackling this binary, how does this help you understand what's going on in your two sites?
Yeah, so I think it's also part of my argument in the book that, as you say, those very concepts, nature and religion, are only partially able to make visible the political contours of these spatial formations that I address in the book. In other words, in order to see the politics and hegemonic power of Buddhist environmental or landscape formations, one needs to work against the binary implications of the words, of the concepts, nature and religion, excuse me, because I think, you know, respectively, they imply a nature-culture binary and sacred-secular binaries. Now, in a context where I'm arguing that there's a primacy to a Buddhist metaphysics, if you like, or a Buddhist philosophy, in instantiations of the taken as given of the normal, these binaries simply don't translate. So, you know, there's an important post-colonial methodological point here, which is essentially that as Emily Apt has put it recently in her wonderful book, Against World Literature, that untranslatability is really important here. Mm-hmm. Untranslatability is precisely that device which allows us to see difference on terms true to the singularity of those differences. And more importantly, I think, you know, if I were to simply translate the Buddhist environmental worldings that I'm interested in as something clunky like Buddhist nature, this, I think, would be to translate out of existence all the specificity and hence political power of those ethnicizing Buddhist aesthetics. So I think that's really what I was trying to do with this kind of attempt to work against or interrogate the concepts of nature and religion, to work through their erasures in this context, if you like.
And it's really nice the way you do this with this aesthetic orientation. This is how you're trying to understand this. I wonder if you tell us, you use this concept a lot, this distribution of the sensible. You use this a lot in your book. Could you tell us a little bit about whose concept this is and how you use it?
Yeah, excuse me. Obviously it comes from Jacques Rancière's work, but I think, I started using the idea of aesthetics in some senses because aesthetics was a way for me to think and work beyond these Enlightenment binaries, the nature-culture binary, the sacred-secular binary. But, you know, I should also emphasize that we need to be very wary because I don't for one minute want to imply there's anything unaesthetic about the nature-culture or sacred-secular binaries. You know, these are lived and felt as much as non-binary worldings. And, you know, there's a great literature in environmental philosophy, people like Arnold Berlant and Emily Brady, who've written really beautifully on this kind of argument. So, you know, for me, Rancière's notion of the aesthetic as a distribution of the sensible, the orchestration of the a priori world, was really useful because it was very much what I was trying to bring into representation in the book. And in a slightly different language, I guess this is the power of hegemony, the construction of a social order, or in a slightly different register again, what Raymond Williams was referred to as structures of feeling. And as I said, you know, this is very much what I was trying to delineate in the book in the context of environmental and spatial formations. But I guess also, you know, it's bringing this back to thinking beyond these kind of binaries, and particularly the sacred secular binary, I should emphasize also that it's, you know, the way the state is able to flip between binary and non-binary renderings of religion really, particularly really interested me, because it's precisely the ability, you know, the state's ability to say religion has no proper place in our political institutions. And it's this kind of statement that buttresses the state's claim to be secular and hence properly modern. When at the same time, as I was trying to show in the book, Buddhism as an ethnicizing structure of feeling, a distribution of the sensible, is omnipresent through the kinds of spaces that I address in the book and in many, many others.
And I guess this is how then you come to describe a sort of a Buddhist nationalist cosmopolitanism, which is going on, right? This sort of tension between being very modern and being cosmopolitan on one hand and quite nationalist at the same time. This is the how you get there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes from, I guess, a sort of more recent critique of the cosmopolitanism literature. And the point really that I wanted to make by that formulation, that cosmopolitan singular Buddhist nationalism, the point I wanted to make here is that it's a way, I think, for singular Buddhist sovereignty to be able to say that, yes, it welcomes difference, diversity, multiculturalism, so on and so forth, but it does so on its own terms. It is the sovereign entitled and able to tolerate non-singular otherness, i.e. Tamils, Muslims, Burghers. It draws the parameters for difference. It produces difference, if you like. Mm-hmm. And this all sounds probably more complicated than it is actually, but in many ways the book was a very simple exercise in trying to unearth just why it feels so natural for so many people in Sri Lanka to say and claim that the country is Buddhist and hence Sinhala, mm-hmm. naturally and historically, all the way back into time immemorial, so to speak. You know, how does this narrative, this performative statement, literally become naturalized, woven into the environment and the landscape all around?
Mm-hmm. And that's a great segue into looking at the book, then looking at the two sites more in depth, because it's exactly how you take some. And so, yeah, before I say something, maybe you should tell us then a little bit about your first site, this Ruhuna. Should I say Ruhuna? Yeah, Ruhuna National Park. Yeah. So, could you tell us a little bit about this park before we start to discuss your argument from it?
Yeah, I mean, in some senses, it's the archetypal space of national nature, space the state has carved out as something of a shop window for its nature. And, you know, given my answer to some of your previous questions, I'm using the word nature advisedly, consciously here. You know, it's Sri Lanka's most famous national park, arguably positioned, located in the southeast of the country. Mm-hmm. One that, like many others, began its life as a game sanctuary in the early 20th century, actually the very late last couple of years of the 19th century in colonial Ceylon. And over the century has become a tourist attraction. It was deeply embedded in projects of nation building in the post-independence context as well. Excuse me. And I think what interests me is that, yes, it's a space of nature, a space that the state carves out to reflect its national articulation of what Sri Lankan nature is. And in this sense, it's a space that very much articulates this kind of binary understanding of nature culture. But its post-colonial history has seen it become a space where the non-binary Buddhist aesthetics implied by the phrase sacred modernity are also very present through the experiential domains that one's encouraged to engage with in the park's landscape, the flora and fauna, the poetics of park tourism, if you like, but also through the archaeological narratives that are inscribed into the park, narratives of historical Sinhala sovereignty in the face of southern Indian Tamil invasion. You know, Ruhuna was reputed to be a landscape where the deposed Sinhala hero king Duttagamani allegedly regrouped and prepared to retake his northern kingdom from the Tamil invader Ellara. And this is, you know, all written in some of Sri Lanka's sacred historical texts, alleged to have happened some 2,300 years ago. So the national park's a space where these historical and aesthetic narratives are reinscribed and reproduced through a number of mechanisms that I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And And there's a really nice quote that you have from a sign when you enter the park. I'll read it because I think it really sort of captures this bringing together of this of nature and religion and debinarizing it, bringing it together. It says, and this is the start of, this is what how you open the start of chapter 3. It says, through these gates you enter a protected area. The animals, birds, trees, the water, the breeze on your face, and every grain of sands are gifts that nature has passed on to you through your ancestors so that you may survive. These gifts are sacred and should be protected. Whisper a silent prayer as you pass through for the protection of wilderness around you, and ensure that what you see and feel is passed on to the unborn generations to come. Like, wow, you know?
Yeah, it's very moving. Yeah.
That's what you see when you enter a national park. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, in this chapter, when you that you start with this quote, you look what you talk about a little bit here, this inscription, you're looking at archaeology, also historiography on the one hand, but at the other time you're also describing the experience of being in the park, right? You're even describing your own feelings of being in the park. So I was wondering, how does this, you know, often very much state-led inscription and also the feeling of being in the park, how do these two inform each other in the production of space?
Yeah, so I guess my argument in the chapter is simply that there's a common domain of experience that visitors to the park are encouraged to participate in. And, you know, the portal inscription that you read out is a great example of that, the ways that you're encouraged to participate in this aesthetic terrain, if you like. But my argument is that this domain of experience is neither politically innocent, nor is it incidental to the ways that the park has been textualized, written, narrativized through its history. So I begin by focusing on the ways that post-independent state archaeology has played a huge role actually in inscribing that Dudagamani historiographical narrative that I just mentioned within the park's landscapes. And this involved a lot of archival work looking at the Colonial Office and then Foreign and Commonwealth Office administrative reports, archaeological surveys, and also Department of Wildlife Conservation reports from, I guess, around the 20s or 30s onwards. And particularly in the context of archaeological work, you begin to see that from around the 30s or 40s onwards, you begin to see what I might refer to as the Sinhalization of archaeological work in the park, such that state archaeologists were beginning to write into the park's landscapes their own and dominant historiographical narratives, singular historiographical narratives. They were finding in the landscape evidence of mythical singular history that was recorded in the sacred texts, texts like the Mahavamsa in Sri Lanka. And they were restoring these ruins accordingly, thus in very material ways, I think, building spatial manifestations of a particular type of historiography. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism becomes central to this history writing, but also key is the fact that Buddhism is indissociable from the singular ethnos, from singular ethnicization. But at the same time, you have the development of national park tourism, which was very much part of the post-independent state's program of populist nation building. That is, you know, ways of affording the people cheap and easy access to these national landscapes. And you begin to also see in the wildlife magazines and journals of the time the promotion and writing, I guess, of a particular kind of park experience that, as I argue, overdetermines the park's meaning. So in other words, you know, that there can be no doubt that these feelings of being one with the universe or the sacredness which the park's portal inscription asks visitors to experience, there can be no doubt that these are feelings that are contextually located within the terrain of a singular Buddhist aesthetics of the sacred modernity, that is the book's title. So it's in these ways that I wanted the chapter to make that quite extensive archival research that I did to inform the ethnographic work that was more focused on how the park is commonly experienced. I use my own experiences as a way into that, but I'm trying to sort of reference a much wider domain of experience, common experience, if you like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a part exactly with your experience when you describe climbing up on a hill and really feeling what you're meant to feel in a way, right? Even you as a critical-minded, you know, researcher going there, you even can't, it's hard to escape the feeling.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And yeah, in some senses, these are narrative devices in order to be able to bring home the argument. But, you know, you're absolutely right as well. It is hard to escape those kind of feelings of being very moved, of connecting with some kind of deep history that's written in a particular kind of way, of being able to imagine yourself in a landscape that's as it was, say, 2,300 years ago or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. And this ethnicization of space, and when you move up, when you, it takes on a new dimension in the next chapter, in chapter four, because you start to talk, I guess, a little bit more politically about how the state, how the space, this national park was securitized in terms of a different type of tiger, the Tamil tigers, when they started to make entries into the national park.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is another part, a really important part to the park's politics, which is simply that during the Civil War, particularly through the 90s and early 2000s, Ruhuna was known by many as the Eastern Front, for two reasons, really. One, because within its boundaries, it contained the southern border of the Tamil Tiger separatists' imagined homeland, Elam. And secondly, because in some of its denser jungles closer to the eastern edges of the park, there were encampments of Tamil tiger cadres. You know, these were thick, dense jungles where it was easy for the LTTE to set up camp and evade the government of Sri Lanka army. And there were a few incidents in the late 90s, early 2000s, when tourists in circuit bungalows in the park were kidnapped by the Tamil Tigers, or where bungalows were burnt down, destroyed, etc. And what interested me here was, first, the ways that this was reported in the popular press at the time as the desecration of a particular kind of aesthetic, right? These were experiences of being in the jungle in particular kinds of ways, as I argued in the previous chapter, that sort of being at one with the universe, that these were experiences of being in the jungle that were being lost or were being placed under threat by the tigers. And second, what interested me were the ways that the popular press began to play with the language of endemic species belonging in order to decry the Tamil tiger infiltration of the park. So in other words, everyone in Sri Lanka knows that the largest big cat in Sri Lanka is the leopard. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the tiger has no place in the park. So there was all these kinds of word games around what kind of big cat belonged in Sri Lanka's most famous national park. So, I guess I wanted to show how my arguments about the politics of aesthetics in the park also played into some more obvious and straightforward observations about the politicization of nature and geography. And ultimately, not insignificantly, it was the army, the government of Sri Lanka army, that were able to finally declare Ruhuna safe again for public consumption, which is not insignificant, because this was a space of nature that had to be militarized, protected, in order to become available to the right kind of citizenry again.
Mm-hmm. But this was also a space which had which was a pilgrimage site for Tamils as well. I'm correct, right?
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. So there's some well-known pilgrimage routes through the park, mm-hmm. particularly to a spot called Katragama, that many Tamils, not just Tamils, but lots of Tamils have been doing for years and years, walking for years and years. And through the Civil War, you get these incredibly interesting sort of descriptions of the ways that the state wanted to keep an eye on these Tamil pilgrims for fear that the LTTE would be using these pilgrimage routes and Tamil pilgrims as a way of entering the park, of making it through to the south of Sri Lanka. So you have this real kind of surveillance of the pilgrimage routes and the pilgrims that comes out in many of the government reports as well, and the national press at the time.
That's great. It's really nice. And you do this in both parts of the book, how you move first from, I suppose, another way around, you might think the more simple way to organize it would be to make these big political arguments and then go down to start to think about the more difficult to make arguments surrounding the sort of the unseen aesthetics. But it's nice in both parts. You start the other way around, like building the argument away from the most difficult point. And you do this, like I said, in the first part of the book, which is about Ruhuna National Park, and then the second part of the book when you're talking about a specific type of architecture, which is tropical modernism. And so I have a very simple first question, which I'm sure lots of people will want to know as well. Like, what is this style of architecture, and who were its main and proponents?
Yeah, a very different kind of space to that which I address in the first part of the book, the National Park, Sri Lanka's modernist architecture, pioneered really, I guess, by three quite famous architects in the Sri Lankan context: Minette da Silva, Jeffrey Barwa, and Valentine Gunasekara, from around the late 40s, 1950s onwards. And these were they were Sri Lankan-born architects who all went to study at London's Architectural Association. And they were massively influenced by international modernism and critical regionalism, the emerging seed of this new thing called tropical modernism from the likes of Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew at the Architectural Association. And essentially, De Silva, Barwa, Valentine, Gunasekara were interested in the problematic, I think, of how to translate architectural modernism into something that physically worked in Sri Lanka's tropical environment, in Sri Lanka's tropical environmental context. And, you know, to take this challenge on, they all developed their own styles. In other words, it's fair to say that their work was quite different from one another's, but arguably united by a kind of common desire to build space and spatial experience that melded the outdoors and indoors, to build fluid kinds of spatialities where the outside was brought in and vice versa, creating what many architects these days refer to as infinite or fluid kinds of spatiality, where light, air and air was able to circulate through properties that they built, through space that they built. And their work, I think, has spawned something of a movement now of modern Sri Lankan architecture that continues to do this in all kinds of really interesting and creative ways. So this attention to blending inside with outside has kind of, I would argue, become the hallmark of Sri Lankan architectural modernism in many senses.
Mm-hmm. And for example, I know it's in a later chapter, but it's a good example to explain this. There's a hotel that you describe in some detail, I think it's built by Jeffrey Barwa, no? So maybe you could just describe this a little bit for us, so we can get an idea of what it is to be inside and outside at the same time.
Yeah, this is the Kandalama Hotel in Sri Lanka's Cultural Triangle. And it's a fantastic hotel. It's a big modernist structure that's built into a rock face. So the structure kind of merges with the rock face. Its rooms and hallways are in part open to the environment beyond. It's planted with lots of native vegetation, such that now it can be difficult to pick out the hotel, because it seems to have merged with the planted rock face. And you really do get this sense, you know, moving through this hotel, moving through its spaces, that there is little by way of separation between yourself as you're in these spaces and the environment beyond. And there are all kinds of large features and small details that work to accentuate this kind of spatial experience, the idea that you're part of the environment beyond. So, for example, there are infinity swimming pools that look out to the Kandalama tank lake beyond, reservoir beyond. So when you're in one of these swimming pools, if you're lucky enough to be in one of these swimming pools, your view merges seamlessly with the landscape beyond. So it's supposed to create this illusion that you're swimming in the tank with the bathing elephants, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a brief synopsis really of the hotel. Yeah,
I have to say, you choose your field sites well, like luxury hotels and national parks.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm sure it was a very trying field site in this way.
It was.
So, this, but it's nice you described the feeling, because that's exactly what you move on to talk about in the next chapter, when you're making an argument about how built space has effects on people, just as the same way that people affect meaning of built space. So you're talking about the way in which these tropical modernism buildings, how they really having effects on the people who live there. And you do this through building on interviews with people who live there, but also with architects and students and interns and this as well. So what's the argument you're trying to make here?
Do you mean in terms of the methods I chose, or
no? Both really. So like So why did you choose, both in the terms of the methods, but also in terms of what effect did it have on people, basically the people who lived there as well?
Right, I see. I think so in terms of the, I did want to, it was my own experience of some of these spaces that initially got me interested in the aesthetic terrains or domains of experience that I saw something in. But I think what was really important for me was to try to allow people to tell me about these spaces. You know, why were people commissioning this kind of architecture for their own houses? How were architects actually working with these spaces? How were people using and negotiating these spaces in a kind of everyday kind of way? So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to speak with people about these spaces rather than to just try and describe them.
Mm-hmm.
And in many senses, I think it was really that what came through strongly in a lot of the ethnographic work that I did was this feeling of infinite spatiality, the feeling of not quite knowing when you're inside or outside. That was narrativized in a particular kind of way that connected in many instances with hallmarks or tenets of a Buddhist aesthetics. This idea of infinite spatiality. And again, people would often struggle to describe this to me in my interviews that were conducted in English, not in a singular language, because they didn't have the words for these kinds of experiences. So these were untranslatable experiences in some ways. And that really kind of interested me, because although these weren't political experiences, these weren't historiographical experiences like many that I wrote about in the first part of the book, they were experiences that people would often choose to narrate to me in and through the register of this kind of sacred modernity that I've been trying to think about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm worried now I'm making an unintelligible question, but I just wondered, so how did you get to, how did you speak to these people? How did you get them to talk about this sort of untranslatable or even unthinking experience? How did you get into this?
Mm-hmm. Lots of different ways, really. I mean, I chose to do a number of interviews with people who had commissioned tropical modern architects to build them houses, and I went to their houses. I asked them to show me and describe their houses to me, which was a fascinating experience, and a lot was revealed in those kinds of ethnographic encounters. But then I also I did a lot of work interviewing architects themselves, which was fascinating, but also architectural interns, as you just mentioned, who were deployed in to go and work on these kinds of properties, so shadowing them, really, finding out what it is they were doing when they were doing their drawings, when they were imagining how they would change a particular space to suit a client's needs, so on and so forth. So it was really, trying to get under the skin of this architectural complex, really. Mm-hmm. I think it was in some senses quite haphazard in many ways, but it was also in other senses very revealing. But I have to also say, I mean, there's a lot of ethnographic work, but the other part of this work was also the textual and archival work. So this, there's a big, and indeed there's one chapter in one whole chapter in the book on the kind of the way the architecture is overdetermined by its textual field. There's a lot of writing about this architecture, you know, in coffee table books, style books, in newspaper, magazine supplements, those kinds of things. So I really wanted to kind of get to grips with all this literature as well, mm-hmm. and to understand how the literature was pulling the architecture in a particular kind of direction narratively as well. And the final part of all this, I guess, really is to not underemphasize the role that the state has played in locking the architecture into particular kinds of narratives as well, because Geoffrey Bawa is probably the most famous of these early Sri Lankan tropical modernists in Sri Lanka, was commissioned by the state to do a number of really important national projects, if you like, from around the 1960s onwards. So the Kandalama Hotel, which I just spoke about, was one of those projects. And that was for a national tourism company closely aligned to the state. He was also commissioned to build Sri Lanka's brand new parliament building, and also to build a brand new state university, again, down in Ruhuna. Now, this was all at a time when the state the government was building a state in a way that closely aligned itself with a majoritarian Sinhala ethnos. So it was very much an exclusivist kind of state. So the way that this style, tropical modern style, got subsumed, if you like, by state narratives of what an emblematically Sri Lankan kind of architecture should be. And emblematically Sri Lankan meant Sinhala in many ways, Buddhist in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes, is this... yeah, exactly. This way that the impossibility of artistic autonomy, which is exactly this, is how you can't escape the context within which you're working. But as I'm wondering maybe they have, maybe they haven't. Have you sent this book or some writings to these architects that you did research with, and have they or not?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, uh-huh. And that's really important to me. And it's it's a tricky one, because you know what I'm essentially doing is critically engaging an architectural style that is in some senses so far away from politics that it becomes quite a difficult thing to do. And you know, many would also argue that what I'm doing effectively is ceding to Sinhala nationalism something that is, as I've just said, so far away from the political that it's a tricky game to play, so to speak. But, you know, let me be clear. I think the architects themselves would talk to me about being caught in a kind of trap here, because the architecture has become so associated with this aesthetic formation that the architects can't easily escape it. You know, their clients want a typically Sri Lankan building, one that affords spatial experiences that are legible in particular kinds of ways, and that I argue also reinstantiate a Buddhist structure of feeling that's ethnicized by association. So as a consequence, you know, the market plays a role here in locking the architectural style and narrative together. And architects, a few architects spoke to me about how they really wanted to innovate and try new stuff, but they found it very difficult to, because other if they did, they wouldn't get any work.
Right. This inescapability in a way is a good time then to talk about the sort of hopeful air or hopefulness that you suggest at the end of the last full chapter, and it relates to the wonderful front cover that you've got, which is a pink, very soft looking bed, maybe you should describe it, because then you know its context as well, rather than my poor description. Mm-hmm. So
It's an installation by a fantastic Sri Lankan artist, Tam Sanathanam, Tamil, artist who's based now at the University of Jaffna. And I don't, will there be a image of the cover of the book on the website?
Yes, yeah.
There will. Okay, so listeners will be able to see this as well. So it's an oversized red, very sumptuous, velvety looking bed placed right in the middle of a field which is in one of, it was in Geoffrey Barwer's estate, Lunagunga. And the installation was made at an artist's retreat, as I said, in Geoffrey Barwer's old estate. In other words, right in the middle of the kinds of landscapes that my book focuses upon. And indeed, in one of the chapters, I have a discussion of that precise view that the bed is placed right in the middle of. And as I said, it's this wonderfully sumptuous, oversized red velvet bed. But the thing about it, the installation is called Paradise. The thing about it is that it's made of military sandbags. The materials that the state used to protect itself and its citizenry from the Tamil Tigers during the war. It's really hard. It's really uncomfortable as soon as you go and touch it. So, you know, it was, for me, is this wonderful statement about how everything that's seductive and sumptuous and evocative in Sri Lanka has some underside to it. There's some other slightly more sinister, ethnicized and militarized side to these kinds of landscapes, you know, much like, as I said, with the skirmishes in Rahuna National Park through the 90s and 2000s, it was the army who ended up securing the park and making it safe again for its public, right? So there's this relationship between the evocative, sumptuous landscapes that I write about here and militarization. I think the installation really nicely brings out. And yeah, I firmly believe that we should judge this book by its cover. I can't take credit for the cover because it's the artist's work and it's a fantastic installation, I think.
Yeah, and it's a cover that you don't have explained to you until almost the end of the book as well. So it's a good tease as well after such a wonderful front cover. I wondered like when you decided to write this book, did it originally start as this project that would bring both the Rahuna National Park and tropical volcanism architecture together, or did you originally envisage them as separate projects? I know you mentioned part of it was based on your PhD research, like the architecture stuff. So when you went to do the research in Rahuna, was this always thinking of bringing these two ideas together?
Yes, actually, yeah. I mean, okay. But I think there could be any number of other sites, I think, of nature and environment in Sri Lanka that one could work through, because my argument is that these are in two very different case studies, in two very different sites, spaces, if you like. There's a common aesthetic domain at work, a common, you know, distribution of the sensible that has similar hallmarks and similar refrains and registers that have a politics to them, that orchestrate the social in particular kinds of ways. So one could choose, I think, a number of different sites. And indeed, you know, when I conceived of the book, I did actually think initially that I would have a third case study in the book, which I'd imagine to be around post-tsunami coastscapes in the south of Sri Lanka. And the way that Sinhala Buddhism had shaped reconstruction efforts, the way the disaster itself had been narrativized, so on and so forth. But that it's not that that couldn't be done, but it became a bit unwieldy in terms of actually executing the project or executing the book. So I had to leave that one be. But I have a wonderful PhD student now, Will Wright, who's doing a project on post-tsunami coastscapes in the east of Sri Lanka. So it's not that that has died, so to speak.
It's great. It's great. No, it's amazing. When I first like saw the blurb for the book, I was really thinking, how will you bring these two things together? But of course, this is exactly what you reveal in the introduction, but also by the time you get to the end, is that this is something which could actually be done anywhere, right? These two sites that you chose, but it could be, this is so all pervasive around in Sri Lankan society, or even you can imagine in other contexts where there's you know, a majority and a minority living together, you could really imagine extending this framework into different places as well. So it works really well in that way. It's really nice. So I just thought, like, I've gone through all the chapters, I've asked all my questions, which were maybe a little bit unintelligible at times, but I was wondering if there's anything that I've missed that you'd like to flag up for the listeners.
One thing that it's I guess important to say, and I should have mentioned it in relation to your question about have I sent copies of this book to the architects that I worked with in Sri Lanka, but it was really important for me that this book became available to a Sri Lankan readership, a Sri Lanka-based readership. So Liverpool University Press were excellent insofar as they allowed me to seek a co-publication agreement with a Sri Lankan publisher. So the book is available on the Sri Lankan market through the Social Scientists Association as well. So that was really important to me, to be able to open it up to a territory of critical readers in Sri Lanka as well.
Oh, that's great. That's really good, because of course everyone knows academic books are crazily priced in the West. Let alone when you're in South Asia. That's wonderful. And have you had any? I mean, has there been any? What's the feedback been like from these architects?
It's been really. I've spoken. So I did a round table on the book in Colombo. Mm-hmm. That was last April or March or so, and it was great. Actually, it was a really fantastic level of critical engagement with the book, with the main arguments. I mean, not just from people working in or close to tropical modern architecture in Sri Lanka, but critical social scientists and humanities scholars there as well, and students as well, using some of the ideas in the book to be able to generate their own projects on the politics of space in Sri Lanka. So that was really, really gratifying and experience through which I learned a hell of a lot, actually. So it was really good.
Okay, great. And the traditional last question on the New Book Podcast is to ask you what's your current projects or future projects that you're working on now?
Current projects and future projects. Well, I mean, the work on Sri Lanka continues, and I'm at the very early stages of trying to develop a new project again on aesthetic constitutions of the political in Sri Lanka. But I want to engage a bit more directly with modern art in Sri Lanka. Contemporary art in Sri Lanka, and there's a sort of burgeoning art scene in Sri Lanka since the end of the war. So I'm interested in the ways that artists have dealt with the conflict, and also the role that the market is slowly but surely hitting the Sri Lankan art scene. What's happening to the politics of this art in the context of commodification, so on and so forth. So that's a project that I'm at the very early stages of getting going. And also in terms of the work on architecture that I focus on in the book, I kind of extended that a little bit to think about other South Asian iterations of international modernism, or architectural modernism. And I'd been doing some work on Auroville in southern India, mm-hmm. a utopian settlement in Tamil Nadu, actually, and thinking about the role that modernist architecture has played there in community building and the politics of utopian urbanism, so on and so forth. And those are, you know, two projects that I'm working on sort of in parallel at the moment. But there's also a lot of thinking work, I guess, that addresses the post-colonial methodological problematics that the book tackles around the relationships, for example, between suburban studies and geographical thought, for example, that I'm continuing to work on as well, the politics of knowledge production, so on and so forth.
Brilliant. They all sound really fascinating. I suppose I said it was my last question, but I should have probably asked this question in the beginning. Do you have an architectural background or training, or you always were a geographer? Or
no architectural training or background, which is both a blessing and a curse in many ways, I think, mm-hmm. because I think what's, I mean, in many ways, I really, when I do this research and when I continue to do this research, I really have to be educated about architecture and the way that architects think and work, so on and so forth. But in many senses, you know, following the fantastic work of people like Jane Jacobs, Stephen Cairns, and so on and so forth, I've really been influenced by, you know, that importance of decentering the architect when one looks at the geographies of architecture, to think about the architect as only one node in the ways that buildings work, right? So this is really, I guess, an engagement with built space, and architects build things, yes, but then they're used and they continue to be used and remade by the people who use those spaces. So it's been difficult to work on architecture when one doesn't have an architectural background. Mm-hmm. But it's also been really useful, I think, in terms of thinking about architecture as part of a wider network, if you like.
Sure. But really, again, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. I really strongly recommend the book to everybody. It really is a wonderful book. And thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to talk about the book. And thank you.
Thanks again for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook. We've been talking about Sacred Modernity by Tariq Jazil. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you download the book. And I hope to see you again next time. Ta-ra.